Welcome back to Global Community Forum. I'm Scott Gurian. We continue now with an interview I conducted with David Vittori on September 11th, the terrorist attacks and America's military response.
I thought war was really not an option in this case, and that there were a lot of different ways to be strong, you know, morally strong, ethically strong, legally strong. I don't think war was by any means the first option. I don't think we were forced into it at all. And you know, we're this great nation, and we can take our time. We can get all our ducks in line and really do this correctly. But we're just so quick to want a solution. You know, we just have to have a solution. We just have to go over there and do it. And that's just the way we Americans are. You know, it just has to be done now, so that we can go back to watch our football and, you know, the World Series or whatever. Because this is, it's almost like we're going to lose interest in it. If it isn't done soon, you know, nobody's going to want to do it, so we better jump in and do it soon.
What do you think your brother Jim would say and think about this military response if he was here?
Well, he was a really gentle person, and we're Italians, and, you know, we had a close family growing up, and I know he loved my parents a lot, and he really took care of them and went to see them as frequently as he could and spend time with them. So I just can't imagine him being in favor of this in any way. Like I mentioned a little earlier about him really loving our new son, Zane, his new nephew. It was the first time he has a nephew. And his feelings about children and about family and about my folks, I just can't imagine that he would want any other family to go through this, the kind of pain that we've gone through. And in talking to his wife, I do get the feeling that she feels that way as well. And I have to think that he would have felt that way. But, of course, you can't speak for anyone. And, you know, if I can't speak for my brother, then neither can President Bush or anyone else who says we're doing this for him.
I was going to ask, do you think that the president and other politicians are using your brother and other people like him as an excuse as a justification to go into war?
Well, politicians are always waiting for an excuse to do anything. And, you know, I don't have any anger against President Bush, because I think the president, whoever he is really kind of irrelevant, whether it's Bush or Clinton or Bush or Reagan or Carter or whoever. I think presidents come and go. You know, they come and go every couple of years. We get a new president. But the thing that never changes is U.S. foreign policy. It's always the same. It's been the same for 50 years. Howard Zinn, the historian, came down to North Carolina a couple weeks ago, and there's a woman from Colombia in the audience, and she started asking him some questions about oil. And she said, you know, I live in Colombia, and the reason that there's American military troops there is because there's oil in Colombia. And they're asking him what he was thinking about the war in Afghanistan. And he made the point that American foreign policy since the end of World War II has been about oil, period. And we have been willing for 50 years to sacrifice people's lives for all the oil we can get. And that is the thing that drives us to the Middle East and makes us so obsessed with them. And so it sort of doesn't matter who the president is. It's American foreign policy that we really have to look at and just be honest about. You know, if we can all say to ourselves that we're willing to kill people so that we can drive big cars and waste energy and live that kind of life, then so be it. You know, but let's be honest about it and say that's why we're there. You know, we're there for oil. And the point is, we're told that we have to maintain our way of life, and we're doing this to maintain our way of life, and that people like me are only able to speak out in the way that I'm doing now because of this sort of military intervention. But the point is, the United States is not the only democracy in the world, and there are many democracies in Western Europe, for example, that have higher standards of living than we do, use half as much energy per capita as we do, and get along just fine. So the notion that we have to consume such vast amounts of oil and waste so much energy somehow to maintain our lifestyle is simply wrong. And there are people that are living far better off than we are, that don't do that, and at the same time they're able to give their kids good education and have national health care and take care of their people too.
What do you think about the use of the American flag as a symbol, what it meant both before and after September 11th?
I think what I noticed right away is that everybody had flags out. And then I noticed that they just left them out, you know, they left them out all night. They left them out when it rained and they were starting to get kind of beat up and dirty. And they had them all over their mailboxes and they'd get all, you know, rained on and mud on them. And my dad, growing up, I remember my dad had this big flag, and he still has the same flag that he's always had. And he, you know, he would take it out and hang it up on the front porch on like the 4th of July and Veterans Day and, you know, certain holidays when you hang the flag up, like, you know, Lincoln's birthday and Washington's birthday, back when they had separate birthdays. And he was always very careful that, you know, you hung the flag up. And then when the sun went down, you went out and you got the flag and you folded it up and you put it back in its box and you put it back in the basement or wherever you had it. So, you know, that's how you do the flag. And there's actually a little diagram that comes with the flag. This is how you fold the flag. You fold it over and then you make it into like a triangle or something. And so he treated it very seriously. And he's a veteran. And, you know, that's the way you're supposed to do it. And when I saw people just leaving these flags out, you know, you'd have a flag in front of your house out there when it's raining and the flag's getting wet. That really just kind of affected me the wrong way. You know, I felt like these people just put it out there and they weren't being vigilant. That's the word I was thinking of. You know, you just think that democracy is this thing you just sort of do. It's like, you know, you hand somebody money that comes to the door and says, okay, here, just take this and go away. But democracy is not something where you just hang something up. It's something you have to be vigilant about, and you have to pay attention to it every moment. You don't just do it and leave it and come back, you know, a month later and check on how it's going. So that's my thought. I'm still kind of angry when I see those flags hanging there, and I'm angry I see these stickers that some radio station down in North Carolina in my area is sending out, these flag-shaped stickers that say, "We shall overcome," and it's in this, I want to say military type, but it's in this very bold sort of masculine, you know, football sort of type. So it's clearly not "We shall overcome" in the words of the old Negro spiritual, but it's military "We shall overcome." And that turns me, that sort of makes me feel weird too. So I'd have to say that all uses of the flag rub me the wrong way.
Do you think that it's meant different things to different people in the aftermath?
Oh, yeah. And I know a lot of people are saying, well, it's our flag and we should fly it proudly and reclaim our flag and not let people take it and use it for symbols such as, you know, more war or whatever. But I have to admit, I still have kind of an uncomfortable feeling about the flag. And I didn't have that before now. But, yeah, I have a little kind of a weird feeling about it.
I imagine in the last several months you must have sort of undergone a very complex mix of emotions from, I guess, mourning and maybe some anger, and then sort of moving past that maybe towards some sense of resolution or reconciliation. Let's speak a bit about that.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
No, I don't even think I've really begun to mourn. It was kind of an odd situation because it's this public event, and as a family member, you're just in shock. So everyone else is out there just going crazy because this thing has happened, but you're in shock. You're not feeling anything. Everybody else is feeling it because they're going crazy. And then a month later or 2 months later, you're not in shock anymore, so you start feeling it. But at that point, everybody else has moved on into some other feeling. You know, now they're sort of calmed down a little bit and trying to get back to their normal lives. But that's when I just started to feel it. So I feel a little bit like I'm a couple months behind everyone else. And really, I've just been sort of contemplating this for, what is it now? Is it 3 months almost? You know, a couple weeks, it'll be 3 months. I really feel like I'm still just sort of sitting there trying to figure out what happened. You know, I'm just trying to process what happened on September 11th, regardless of whether my brother was involved or not, I think it was the kind of event that deserved a lot of contemplation on our part, personally and as a country, that we really just needed to sit down and think and think and think about what happened. And we didn't do that. So I think we missed that collectively. And I can tell you that's what I'm still doing right now, almost 3 months after the fact. I'm still just pondering what all this means. And I don't know. And I wish that the rest of my country were pondering it with me instead of just being told to shut up and get on with your lives and go back to work and go to the mall and do everything you were supposed to do. I think that's just so sick and so dysfunctional. We should experience our grief and talk to each other and give each other permission to just say things that might not be politically correct and disagree with each other and just have conversations. And out of all of those conversations, we will start to get at the answer of what we should do next collectively. But unless we, that's not going to happen unless we have those conversations and with people continually telling us essentially to just shut up and go back to work, that's not going to happen. So that does anger me. And I think we should be giving each other permission to just say, let's sit down and think about this for a while, just like I'm doing.
But I guess you've undergone some sort of transformation from mourning, which, as you say, you're still sort of going through, but transforming that into action, moving forward and speaking out for peace.
Yeah, I mean, there's been an evolution in that sense, but also I remember President Bush saying we should all go back to doing what we were doing before September 11th. And what I was doing before September 11th was questioning the way we do things and being critical in the best sense of foreign policy and decisions made by our government, because it is our government. So I feel like I'm sort of being patriotic and doing what I was told to do, going back and, you know, doing what I was doing before this. But yeah, I guess you're right. I'm sort of taking it out of my home office and out of my seat at the computer and taking it into the street, which is where I think it belongs. And it feels very funny. You know, I've been standing, you know, in circles of people. We'll march somewhere and we gathered in the park today and we'll just sort of tell our stories to whoever happens to show up. And it's just been very odd to be telling these really personal stories to complete strangers. But there's something very therapeutic about that. So yeah. And another point I wanted to make was I sort of feel like I have nothing to lose. Having gone through this, having lost my brother, that's sort of like the worst thing that could possibly have happened, short of me dying, but then who would care? I wouldn't care. You know, and in a sense, I feel like I have nothing left to lose because I've already lost the most I could lose. And out of that, it's made me feel that I can't just sit around and feel sorry for myself and mourn in private and have my own private grief. Why don't I just go out? Why don't I say something and see what happens? Because I have nothing left to lose. And I really feel like that's the same mindset of the people who did this, who were driven to whatever desperate stage they were at to do this desperate act. They must have felt, and I'm just inferring this, but they must have felt like they had nothing left to lose. You know, they were in such a desperate situation. Why don't we just do this heinous crime? Because we have nothing left to lose. And it's interesting that we both were feeling the same things, but they took down the World Trade Center, and I'm sort of pointing that energy towards the peace movement. So it just demonstrates that when you put people in that position, it can go either way. And it might go a bad way, or it might go a good way. I feel like I'm putting my energy in a good direction, but I think it could just as easily go in a bad direction, and that's something to think about when we start dropping bombs indiscriminately all over the world. You know, something's going to come back, and we don't always know what it's going to be, or may not be what we expect it to be.
So you feel the need and perhaps a responsibility to speak out for peace?
I don't feel like a leader or something. I just feel like I need to say this for me. So even if nobody cares, it doesn't matter. I mean, I have to be true to myself and just say this. And having said it, I'm satisfied. You know, I don't care if the newspapers cover it or if we get on TV or, you know, if I get a nice letter from somebody. I really don't care. I mean, it's nice if that happens and you can sort of spread the message. But having just done it, I feel like I've done what I wanted to do, and that's good enough for me.
What about the sense of, I guess, being a minority in this political climate now that's developed where everyone is so unified pushing for war?
Well, says who? You know, who says we're all unified? Howard Zinn, I mentioned before, I met him before his speech and kind of talked to him, and he's been traveling around doing lectures, and I said, you know, what do you see when you go out there? You've been doing lectures all over the place. And he said, you know, there really is this blanket support for President Bush, whatever it was, 80%, 90%. And he said that that's very normal after a national crisis like this. Everybody wants to support the president and show unity. But he described that support as being paper thin. He said it was very, very thin support. And that once you start engaging people in a conversation, you know, a rational civil discourse and just sort of talking about alternatives and why we should be doing one thing or another thing, that they pretty much turn around immediately and start questioning this. So it's easy to put a poll on the TV screen that says, you know, we have this huge amount of support for this, but it is, I believe, and I agree with him, that it's a very shallow support. And everyone I've met, you know, virtually 99% of the people I've met have demonstrated that. They've greeted us very nicely. They've shown their agreement with what we're talking about. And again, I'm not talking about anything specific, but I'm saying there's a thirst out there for alternatives and for more discussion. And the feeling that I get, and this is just my feeling from being out there, is that people are really, really hungry and very, very much wanting to hear alternative points of view so that they can take all the information they can get and make their own decision rather than having this cram down their throat that this is what we've got to do. We've all got to line up. We've all got to be unified. Because we don't all have to be unified. We can take our time and decide what we want to do, because that's what you do in a great, powerful nation. You take your time and decide what you want to do. So that's what I think we should be doing.
Have you watched any television news or been following anything since then? Are you able to tolerate it, or do you just not?
I don't watch TV. I used to work in TV, and I haven't really watched TV for about 5 years. But we did turn it on. We don't even have cable, so we did turn it on, you know, to kind of sample things. And we would just turn it on for a few minutes and just really, you really only needed a few minutes to get the gist of it, because they would basically be saying the same thing over and over and over again. And I get most of my news from the alternative media, from the internet mainly, and from magazines in these times, The Nation. And it was so fascinating when this whole anthrax thing was going on, the networks were just, it was just all anthrax all the time, you know, all the things on the screen, anthrax this and anthrax that. And I sort of got a taste of that. And then I went on the internet and I found all these other really interesting stories that had nothing to do with anthrax, you know, about the history of the region and our pursuit of oil and this and that. And I just got this huge dose of all these alternative points of view and things we should be doing now. And I felt really great. And then like a week later, I went back and turned the TV on. And it was like exactly the same as I had seen a week before. It was all anthrax this and anthrax that, and it was like nothing had changed in a week. And that was such a clear demonstration to me of the absolute inadequacy of the mainstream media right now to give us what we need so that we can make a decision about, a knowledgeable decision about what we should do. They just take this one terrible thing, you know, the anthrax stuff was obviously terrible, but you know, there are other things going on in the world besides that. So that was just a clear demonstration to me that, man, if you want to get news, you know, go to other alternative sources of news, because they're the only place you're going to get it.
I recall reading a pretty interesting editorial you had written for the alternet.org website relating an experience you had listening to National Public Radio. I don't know if you want to relate that or summarize what you'd written.
I had turned on the radio the Monday morning after we started bombing Afghanistan, and who's the guy in Morning Edition?
Bob Edwards.
Right. And it's Cokie Roberts. And, you know, Bob Edwards welcomes Cokie Roberts and says something like, well, we began bombing Afghanistan yesterday. Was there any dissent in Congress? And Cokie said, none that mattered. And that was her, you know, that was how she pretty much dismissed everyone else. It was like none that mattered. And it was just outrageous to me that this is, I mean, I don't know if she's considered a reporter or a commentator or what, but I mean, that's not something you say if you're a legitimate reporter, none that mattered. What a valued judgment. You know, why don't you say who was against it, whether it was Barbara Lee or who else? You know, you don't just dismiss everyone.
Barbara Lee, the congresswoman from California.
Right, who did not vote for the blank check to use force.
The sole vote against
in
the Congress.
Right. And I was just flabbergasted, and it was the kind of thing, you know, occasionally I hear things on NPR that make me practically drive off the road, and I usually go home and write them a letter, or I write something, and this was just like too much. So I think I just sat down immediately and wrote this thing in like 5 minutes and basically just applied that phrase to just everything having to do with U.S. foreign policy and, you know, the Kyoto Accords, you know, do any of our decisions make any difference to people? None that matter. You know, are people killed in Yugoslavia? None that matter. And it just seemed like this wonderful phrase that just applied to everything. And it got picked up by Alternet. And that thing, you know, occasionally I'll just check on it. I'll go on the internet and see who's picked it up just for fun. And that thing has been picked up by like 15 websites. And it's in Sydney, Australia. And it's in France and Holland and Canada. And, you know, it just touched a nerve. I mean, I don't claim to be some brilliant writer, but clearly it touched a nerve somewhere for all these people to be putting it on their websites. So, you know, somebody out there feels the same way I do, I have to believe, right?
I actually remember hearing that as I was listening to NPR one morning and as I was driving and I was drove off the road as well. Certainly hit me knowing that there is a peace movement out there and lots of people, including people like yourself, relatives of victims, speaking for peace now. And again, if people want to read that article, they could go to Alternet, alternet.org. David, how do you think that the events of September 11th have sort of changed your outlook on things and maybe your plans for your life if they've gone that far or just sort of moving on from here, where you go from here?
I don't know. I'm sort of at a point in my life where I've left a career. I had a career in television for a while and was well paid and just kind of got tired of the culture and got tired of the people and moved to North Carolina from LA to go to graduate school at Chapel Hill and get a master's in folklore, which I'm still working on. And so our lives have just been sort of up in the air. I'm a part-time writer. I do stuff in public radio and public TV down there, and my wife teaches English at college, for which she is rewarded with $20,000 a year. And so we're both kind of broke, and we're raising this baby, and we're kind of swapping off with taking care of him because we can't afford to put him in daycare, and we really don't want to. And so it's almost like this is happening at a time of great ferment in my own life, and I don't really know what I want to do. It's a funny thing to say when you're 45 years old that I don't know what I want to do, but it's also a wonderful thing because you can sort of do anything you want. So I have to say I don't know. I'm thinking like I should get a regular job, and now I'm thinking like I don't have to get a regular job, that I can be part of a movement that's bigger than all of us. And I remember working for a Ralph Nader group out in L.A. called the Oaks Project and seeing Mr. Nader speak a few times. He would come to town and talk to us and give us a pep talk. This was a civic group out there. And he said, you know, don't you want to be able to tell your kids and your grandchildren that I spent my life working for social justice? You know, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to be able to tell them instead of saying, well, you know, I worked as a stockbroker for my whole life so that I could buy a nice car at the end of that or whatever. But I still remember that, you know, wouldn't it be great to say that you spent your life working for social justice? And I have to agree with him. So I hope that I can spend my life working for social justice, because it feels good and it's just fun. What can I say? It's a good time to be with good people who have good hearts and good values. So I would like to spend my life working for social justice, and that's what I'm going to do. I don't know how, but I think I will.
Have you met with other relatives of other victims?
I've corresponded with some of them on the internet, and we're having a press conference on Monday to announce some sort of formation of a website where people can post alternative views and where we can hook up with other family members. So that's kind of in the works. We don't know what that's going to be yet. So,
and you... I know earlier today, I think for the first time, you had walked by the World Trade Center in mm-hmm. that area. What was that like?
It was bad. It was bad. It was bad. We took the ferry from Staten Island. That's how we got into Manhattan. And, you know, I started crying on the ferry when we came over, because you just look at that skyline. This is the first time I've been back to Manhattan in 5 years. And you just look at that skyline, and it's like, it's gone. It's this big hole. So to see it was really very moving. And then to just walk up, we walked up Broadway, and to just look through those buildings and see the what was left of the World Trade Center. There's that, you know, one piece of it is still sticking up in the air. And you just see this twisted rubble, and you just think that, you know, someone you loved was in that, you know, and that all your family memories and, you know, Christmas and holidays and, you know, they were all in there too. So it was pretty hard. It was pretty hard. And the other hard thing was just to be in the middle of all these people that were shopping. And I don't know how to describe it, just all these people just coming at us. You know, we were kind of going in the opposite direction from all the shoppers, and they just didn't seem to care at all. You know, they weren't being contemplative. They didn't seem somber. I mean, maybe it's been a few months. Maybe it was different at the beginning, but it was very hard to take, because it was like, you know, don't you people know what just happened here? You know, how can you just go back to buying CDs on the street again? So I felt bad personally, and I also felt bad to be among all those people, because there was a feeling of, I feel like I'm being very judgmental here, but just this feeling that they still don't get it. You know, they're still sort of living in denial. And if you really got what happened on September 11th, you're not walking around buying CDs, you know, you're doing something else, and they're not doing something else. So that makes me a little uncomfortable.
Are you hopeful at all?
Well, I don't know if you'd call it hopeful, but I really feel like we just can't go on this way. So I feel like we're either going to get our act together, or we're not going to be around anymore. I really do feel that very deeply. And I, you know, I think, gee, how am I going to get along, you know, with this having happened in my life? And then there are other times when I think we may not even be here this Christmas, you know, or this New Year's. Who can say? You know, we're unleashing these forces in the world, and anything can happen. Overnight, the world can change again. So I feel very calm, because I realize that we either have to get our act together, or there's not going to be any more world. And so I'm kind of thinking about my soul right now. I'm not worried about getting anthrax, and I'm not buying Cipro, and I'm not buying gas masks. I'm trying to polish up my soul, because the soul is the only thing you take with you when you die. And as Don Henley says, there's no hearses with luggage racks, you know. And so I don't really care what happens to my body or if the world blows up, because I realize I really have to get my soul together. So that's what I'm thinking about. I'm doing this for my soul. And if I save my soul, that's all I'm taking with me.
And with that, we wrap up another edition of the Global Community Forum. We appreciate listener feedback and suggestions. You can drop us a line by writing to Global Community Forum, care of Radio for Peace International, Post Office Box 88, Santa Ana, Costa Rica. You could also email your comments to us at info@rfbi.org. That's info podcast@rfpi.org. As usual, this program will be archived on our website. You could listen to it at your leisure by going to www.rfpi.org. Go to that same address to order copies of today's show from our online catalog. Music on today's show is by Michael Franti and Spearhead. I'm Scott Gurian. From all of us here at Radio for Peace International, thanks for listening.
Whoa, we may even find a solution. Hunger and disease, we can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.